I'm very, very happy and grateful to introduce our very, very first speaker, who is going to be like the overture of the symphony called the Chizuk Mission, February 2025. Rabbi Mordechai Berg, who has become very much a real favorite, if I could say, to the Chizuk Mission. Last night, when I arrived, you know when you first arrive, you don't know what time, where it is, what day, what have you. But I got onto the Achabura. Rabbi Berg actually just started from all of his teachings, a 7-week Chabura with us. So I got to hear lots of beautiful, inspiring things last night. Anyway, but Rabbi Berg is the Menahel of Mivaseret. And I always tell Sari, Rabbi Berg, I'm going to do it again. Can I just do it? Rav Gad was supposed to be teaching for us. You know this story, some of you. Shake your head. And he wasn't able to do so. So I said, well, who are we getting? Like, who are you giving instead? He said, trust me, which he normally does to me. Just trust me. And he introduced us, the Chizuk Mission, to Rabbi Mordechai Berg. And since then, he's really been a major, major staple. That's what I want to say. A staple that not just now in Eretz Yisrael, but in America and virtually. And I just personally want to say it's so nice to see you in person. Very much so. I want to point out that Rabbi Berg has an unbelievable, unbelievable Parsha series, a safe Svarim, that I encourage everybody to be able to get because it's life-changing. It really, really is. It's deep. It is spiritual. And it is awesome. So his books are going to be in the hotel for anybody that wants to purchase them. Without further ado, Rabbi Berg, thank you for being here. And thank you for being in person with us.
Full transparency, I don't know if people know this, but public speakers, even public speakers who speak a lot, get nervous. I believe in the power of vulnerability. I know that the Chizuk Mission is a place of great depth and profundity and definitely a lot of vulnerability. For those that are new here, this ought to be an exciting program for you. But I come to the Chizuk Mission, and I'll be honest, I don't feel nervous. I feel like I'm home. But I was all ready to give an introduction, and Barry, you just ruined it. Because the introduction was going to be, I finally feel, after how many years has it been that we've been doing this? I don't know, it's been years already that we've been doing this. So I was going to say, I know I finally made it. I think I'm on the board of the Chizuk Mission now. I know I finally made it because she didn't introduce me, this is what I had in my head, as Rav Gav brought him in when he couldn't make it. So I was like all set to say, I'm finally part of the Chizuk Mission. Maybe next time. Next week, Wednesday, when I come back. You'll still introduce me that way. It won't make a difference. When Rav Gav comes, do you say he was the mistake that Rav Berg brought it? So how many people here know Barry for a while already? Just show of hands. Okay, so a lot of you. So what I'm going to say to you is not going to be new. I get a WhatsApp from Barry. This is always the way it goes. Do you have a couple minutes to speak? Sure. And I drop everything to speak to Barry because Barry's doing the work that Klal Yisrael needs in a very serious way. So you can say this is true. I'm Mamish, how fast did I call you back? I try to call Barry back as fast as possible. And she does this thing where she says, okay, I have the following 50 ideas in my head. I just want to say them all. And then that's what she does. She says them all. She says it's going to be 60 seconds, usually about 8 to 10 minutes. And then she says, does that make sense? And I said, yes, that makes sense. In my head, I was thinking, you give the shiur. I don't need to do this. I mean, I'm happy to make the parnasa, but like, you just gave in 8 to 10 minutes what could easily have been an hour and a half shiur on exactly what she wants the Chizuk Mission's mission statement to be. Rav Berg, you're starting us off. You're setting the pace. You're setting the tone. So I need you to somehow convey these ideas. And then I did what Rav Gav does to her. I learned it from him. I did the same thing. I said, do you trust me? She said, yes, I trust you. And this is the product of that trust. So we have about, I would say, a 70% chance of nailing what you wanted me to say. I'm not going to say the things you said to me because then you could give this year. But I'm going to try to, in a new way, maybe in a different voice, convey the message that we spoke about of what the mission is for this particular chizuk mission. Okay? Good introduction? Okay, thank you for the validation. Means a lot to me. Okay. There's an unbelievable medrash in Esther Rabbah. We're holding now by Purim. You already were Mavarech the Chodesh. It's 3 weeks to Purim. I don't know if any of you were in shul this past Shabbos, but something happens in shul when they're Mavarech the Chodesh. Whoever is making the Berachas HaChodesh is obviously going to do it to a tune of Misha Nechnas Adar. And something changes in the air. You know, it's like, the tefillah we say is Misha Asan Isam Lavoseinu. But the chazan in our shul in Ramat Beit Shemesh this past week, he started singing Misha, 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 Misha Asan Isam Lavoseinu. And everyone was like, oh, that's a good one. Never heard that one before. It's cute, you know. But something changed in the shul. Even, you know, we're 40, 50-year-old men at this point, and guys in the shul, like little children, were all like, eh. It's coming. You know, like it's there's a certain lightness, obviously in a very dark time. There's a certain lightness that permeates the shul. So we're really already holding by Purim. I think it's fair and appropriate to speak about Purim. There's an unbelievable medrash that I want to share with you, a medrash in Esther Rabbah, but it's deep. It's deep. This is not a light shear. This is not fluff. We're not doing fluff. We're doing real Torah to try to make a real impact. I know that's one thing I know for sure about the Chizuk mission. If you show up on the Chizuk mission, you don't have something real to say. Barry's going to call me out. You'll call me out. You'll say it in a very appropriate way, but it'll be very sharp. You know, it'll be like, well, I don't think that's true. You know, like it's very, so I'm going to try to say something real. I'm going to try to say something deep. The Medrash says over a mashal. It's an amazing mashal. The mashal goes as follows. To what can Haman be compared? To a bird that makes his nest on the shore of the sea. So imagine a bird comes, there's the sea. The sea has got all its waves. The bird comes and plants a nest right on the edge of the sea, right on the shore of the sea. What happens? Naturally, the shore of the sea comes and sweeps away the nest. The bird becomes furious, fuming at the sea. And the bird says, I will not budge from this place until the sea becomes dry land, and dry land becomes the sea. I'm not going to move. This is my new mission, the destruction, the obliteration of the sea. I'm going to be persecuting the sea. So what does the bird do? So the bird flies into the water, takes a gulp of water from the sea, carries it back to shore, spits it out on the beach, picks up in its beak a bit of sand, brings it out into the sea, and drops it. That's the mashal so far. You can imagine this bird picking up the water, bringing it to the beach, bringing the beach back into the sea. Obviously, this bird has friends. And the bird's friends, you know, like an intervention, you know, like they sit this bird down and they say, what are you doing? You're never going to be able to take the beach and bring it to the sea, and take the sea and bring it to the beach. How are you planning on doing this? Similarly, says the Medrash, this is exactly what happened between Haman and Klal Yisrael. Somehow, again, this needs to be understood, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Haman, he said, you fool, you fool. You thought you were going to be able to destroy Klal Yisrael. You thought you were going to be able to take the beach and bring it into the ocean, take the ocean and bring it onto shore. I myself tried to destroy Klal Yisrael. This is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Haman. And I wasn't able to do it. You think you're going to be able to destroy Klal Yisrael? That's the Medrash. We're going to have four questions on this Medrash. But just to reiterate, what's the message of the Medrash? What's the message of the Medrash? Number one, the bird built a nest. Number two, the sea swept away the nest. Number three, the bird tries to destroy the sea. Number four, the friends say this is impossible. So to HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Haman, this is impossible. That's the Medrash. It's four questions on this Medrash, and then we're going to start talking for real. The four questions are as follows. anytime the Medrash gives us a mashal, the mashal is telling us something that we otherwise would not have known. Right? For example, if you're teaching a class and you give a mashal to the class, it's because otherwise they can't understand the material. But if something is obvious, you don't need to give a mashal. If I was writing this Medrash, I think I would have just written it as follows. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Haman, it's impossible to destroy Klal Yisrael. That's the point of the Medrash, right? So what's this whole mashal of the bird and the sea and the nest and the bird's attempt to destroy? It doesn't seem to add anything that we don't already know. That's our first question. The second question is as follows. Who threw the first punch in that mashal? The bird comes and puts its nest down. Who throws the first punch? I would say the sea. Because the sea comes and destroys the nest. Well, in the nimshal, who's the bird? The bird is Haman, right? Haman's trying to destroy the sea. We're the sea. So it almost appears to be that we are responsible for Haman trying to destroy us. Because Haman came and he put down a nest. We came and destroyed the nest. So Haman is attacking us because of something we did. That's very strange. When you were learning the Purim story, did anyone here learn that we threw the first punch? I never learned that. I learned that Haman wanted these irrational things. He wanted us to bow down to him like an Avodah Zarah. Mordechai refused to do it. It enraged him. He came after Klal Yisrael. I never learned in the Purim story that we threw the first punch. When did we throw the first punch? How did that happen? That's the second problem with the Medrash. The third problem in the Medrash is the bird in the Medrash seems very foolish, right? You're not going to be able to take the sea and bring it onto the beach. You're not going to be able to take the beach and bring it into the sea. That's a foolish bird. In the Purim story, Haman is anything but a fool. In fact, Haman is so successful in his plot that A, he literally almost wins, and B, even though at the end we won, at the end of the story, are we free? Not at all. Akati avdei Achashverosh anan. We remain slaves of Achashverosh, meaning even though he wasn't capable of annihilating us, he definitely kept us marginalized. It was a very dangerous time. Even the decree didn't go away. We just got another decree that we were able to defend ourselves. Haman was an empowered person. He had a thoughtful plan. Is it really true that Haman is a fool? Doesn't appear to be the case that Haman's a fool. So we don't understand the parallel in the Medrash where the bird is doing something very foolish. God bless you. Yeah. And then at the end of the day, Haman doesn't appear to be foolish at all. And last but not least, and this is the most powerful of all the questions, what's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's answer to Haman? You think you're going to be successful? I wasn't successful. What are the chances you're going to be successful? First of all, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could do anything. So what does it mean that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can't wipe out Klal Yisrael? What does it mean that he attempted to? What does it mean that he couldn't? And what's he saying to Haman? What's HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying to Haman? Go ahead, try. It's not going to work. I'm much more powerful than you and I couldn't do it. Certainly you can't do it. What's the Kal V'chomer? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is infinite. Haman's a Rasha. Okay. So those are the four questions. Just to review very quickly. Number one, the mashal doesn't seem to add anything. Number two, the sea sweeps away the nest. That seems to be the first punch. I don't know where we threw the first punch towards Haman. Number three, the bird seems to be foolish. Haman seems to be smart. And number four, what does it mean that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is unsuccessful? Okay, those are our four questions on the Medrash. I want to have a real conversation right now about a very difficult topic that I don't think a lot of us think is relevant to us, but it's super relevant to us. It's super relevant to us, not only as a nation, which it's obviously relevant to us as a nation, but it's relevant to every woman sitting in this room right now. It's relevant to myself. You could live in the frumest community. You could live in Lakewood, Muncie, the Five Towns, Brooklyn. Doesn't matter where you live. This is relevant to you. It's relevant to me here in Eretz Yisrael. The topic is, and I know it appears to be out of nowhere, the topic is anti-Semitism. What in the world is going on right now? There's this wild level of anti-Semitism that exists in the world right now. Again, I know that it existed in Europe. I knew that it existed in the Holocaust. But I'll be very honest with you. I thought growing up that my Rebbeim were out of touch. I don't know if you had Rebbeim like this. I thought my Rebbeim were out of touch. I was zeich to have unbelievable Rebbeim. I went to a yeshiva called Yeshiva Darche Torah for 4 years. That was the only years I was educated until I was 18. I had 4 years of amazing rebbeim in Darche. I loved my rebbeim, tzaddikim. Thank you for those who just got the joke. I loved my rebbeim. One thing about them, I thought they were out of touch. Because my four rebbeim in Darche for 4 years in a row, they said, don't think that it can't happen in America. Don't think that what happened in Europe in the Holocaust, don't think that it can't happen in America. I'm a kid growing up in the Five Towns. I grew up in a place called Farakwe and then later in Lawrence. Anybody here from the Five Towns? Okay, we've met. Where are you from?
Cedarhurst.
Cedarhurst, okay, I'm from Lawrence. I think I'm better than you. Yeah. Farakwe, I certainly know I'm better than you. I grew up as a Farakwe kid trying to be a Lawrence kid. Where in Farakwe?
Jarvis Avenue.
Oh, okay, from Annapolis. Almost neighbors. Where on Jarvis? Close to...
Opposite Tag.
The opposite side of Tag.
No, the opposite of Tag. I'm
oh, meaning your opposite Tag. Oh, sure. I stayed there just a bit ago on at Hinda Burstein's house down the block.
Oh, that's the other side.
Yeah. Who else from Farakwe? You I know already. You I know already. You I know already. Okay, you stay there. So I'm from the Five Towns. What's the worst thing that happens in the Five Towns in the 80s? Nothing. Not there's no anti-Semitism. The most that happened is you get your bike stolen. That was like... And then in the 90s, that was already gone because everybody in the neighborhood was Jewish. And anti-Semitism, what are we talking about? What are you talking about? It could happen today. I didn't believe them bechlal. And before October 7th, way before October 7th, we started to feel the tremors of anti-Semitism in the world. No, we started to hear things that were very uncomfortable. For sure we heard about them in Europe, but we were menutak from it. We were in Eretz Yisrael, we were in America. The things that happened in France, loch patlanu, okay, it didn't really bother us. It's not really part of our world. And then when October 7th happened, again, I give you all a bracha that you're never on social media, but if you're on social media, the level of anti-Semitism from these faceless, nameless accounts where they have free reign to say whatever they want, all you have to do is type in the word Jew. I promise you the things that come up will not be positive. The craziest things in the world, things that make absolutely no sense. And we're seeing this resurgence right now. We're seeing it in the craziest way. There's no moral equivalence in this war on any level. I think, again, the Levaya is tomorrow, and they've asked that it be a private Levaya. I'm guessing that if the Bibas funeral was not a private Levaya, I'm guessing there would have been at least 100,000 people there. It would have been a Levaya like we have for G'dayle Hador, and it would have been of all shapes and sizes, of all stripes, of all communities in Klal Yisrael, everybody would have been there. We would expect, I think probably everybody on the Chizuk mission would have told Barry, we're not going up north, we're going there. I think we would have changed the itinerary. There'd be nothing to talk about. The solidarity that we experience right now with the Bibas children, it's not exactly clear why, no? Like, it's not exactly clear to us why these children touched our hearts. Lots of children were killed on October 7th. Something about these kids became a symbol for Klal Yisrael. And there's a sensitivity. There's a sensitivity that we have. When they sent the original coffin that did not hold the body of Mrs. Bibas, that they tried to fake us out and send a different corpse, which obviously is levels of evil that are so, so barbaric, they're hard to comprehend. And they wrote on the coffin, arrested October 7th, 2023, arrested an innocent mother there with her children. If you've seen the videos, and I hope you haven't, but if you've seen the videos, a mother who has a look of terror in her eyes, who's holding on to her children, just trying to shield them from what she inevitably knows is going to be a very dark, very difficult period. We saw the video of two children with orange hair. We saw already like a year ago that there was this video of these children with orange hair, and everybody's, oh my God, are they still alive? Like, we've been holding on to hope for these children. The fact that they paraded through the streets, you're talking about evil, evil people parading through the streets with the coffins of children screaming, you know, Allahu Akbar, like these things, we wouldn't believe, that we would think they're mythical. We would think we were living 3,000 years ago. It's just like, you know, Genghis Khan levels of barbarism. We've never seen anything like this. And if you go online, and don't, But if you go online, you'll find a lot of people, you know, posting orange hearts and Israeli flags and orange colors and, you know, very beautiful things that people are posting because they want to have some way of expressing their solidarity. I appreciate it. I think it's meaningful. You will find much, much, much more of people saying, oh, you don't like it when your children are killed? Well, do you know how many children have been killed since October 7th? And they say these things, these people say these things, and they believe Be'emunah Shleima that they're right, which is sick, as if we could draw a straight line between a child whose murder, they're saying now that these children suffered immeasurably physical torture, and that they did despicable things to the body to try to cover up the acts that they did to make it appear that they were killed in an Israeli Air Force strike, which we know is not true. We have experts in forensics that told us exactly how these children died. There's a difference between parading children through the streets in their coffins and saying, this is our expression of God is great, and our people that are doing our very best, almost to the point of absurdity, perhaps past the point of absurdity, to do whatever we can at the risk of our own people to go in on the ground and not, because we, you know, they talk about genocide. That could be a real thing for us. You know that. It would not take much for the Israeli Air Force to really have a genocide in Gaza. It's not a crazy thing at all. How many other nations in the world would show this level of restraint? How many soldiers have we buried, friends of my family, deeply, you know, people that we're connected to in the community, people that we love, how many soldiers have we buried in the last year and a half in our attempt not to commit genocide, in our attempt to go door to door and really only to take out the terrorists? And we know that, unfortunately, there's collateral damage, and unfortunately, sometimes, even in our attempt to do the best possible that we can, innocent children are killed in the line of battle. That's what happens. Is anyone on our side? Have you seen any celebrations? I haven't seen any celebrations. I have not seen Israelis walking around shooting guns in the air saying, we killed a 7-year-old. Have you seen it? I haven't seen it. And they call it anti-Zionism, in the words of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, anti-Zionism is just the latest mutation of anti-Semitism. They've always had reasons to hate us. This is just another one in a long line of reasons that they've given. They say, what do you mean? They kill children, they kill children. You don't like when they kill children? Stop killing their children. As if that's what we're attempting to do. Have we celebrated one death? Absolutely not. Have we murdered children that way? You know any stories of soldiers that choke children to death? And if Chas V'Shalom, something like that happens, these people are held accountable. They stand trial. Who's holding them accountable? Bibi Netanyahu is a war criminal. He's a war criminal. That's a crazy thing. He's a war criminal. When now, in a newly elected government in America, now when there's some voice, and it's a crazy thing to say because he's not exactly the voice of sanity on that side of the aisle. You know, nobody knows what he's going to say from one moment to the next. But the fact that now people have a voice of sanity, like, if you don't start returning hostages, they have no reason to keep the ceasefire deal. Like, and people are like, it's crazy. He's fomenting more war. Look, what are we talking about? So it begs the question, and it's a serious question, whether you've experienced any anti-Semitism in the last year and a half or not, to be blind to the fact that it exists is not okay. It exists, and it exists for a reason. And if HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings it into the world, that means it's a message for us. So we could live in our little bubbles. I could live in Ramat Beit Shemesh. It's a beautiful place. I could not think about any anti-Semitism until the sirens go off. Then it gets a little bit more difficult, right? But you could go through your life and you could not pay attention to it. A Yid pays attention to what's happening in current events because we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is sending us messages. What is the pshat in the message of anti-Semitism? I want to make this question just a little bit bigger because we have to talk about it in a larger context if we're going to have an honest conversation. It's not just anti-Semitism. It's even more than that. There's a darkness that has settled upon the world that I don't know, I can't speak for your lifetimes, but in my lifetime, this is the darkest that's ever been. I'm a grandfather now twice over, Baruch Hashem, and I have two married children, so I'm capable. I feel like I've lived enough of life that I could say things. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you're like a 25-year-old kid saying things, it's like, good for you, man. Like, you have an opinion. You know what I'm saying? But like, if you've lived a bit of life, I think you get to say, like, I've lived for a bit. It is the craziest time. And I don't just mean on an anti-Semitic level. It's the darkest time in my life. There's a basic fear and a basic mistrust that exists in the world on every level, on an economic level, on a political level. I have the opportunity to travel a lot. This is not a bracha. I hope that your husbands are able to have jobs that keep them close to home. My wife is not zaycha for that. That's why it was a privilege to come to speak in the Valley. But also, I like it here in Eretz Yisrael, and I think my family would love it if I stayed here a little bit more. It's not obvious that it feels comfortable to walk through airports in America anymore. You know what a Jew knot is? Can I teach you what a Jew knot is? It's the most beautiful thing in the world. A Jew knot, J-E-W-N-O-D. It's one word, Jew knot. A Jew knot is when you're walking through the airport, and it doesn't matter where you are, you could be in LAX, you could be in O'Hare, you could be in LaGuardia, you could be in JFK, and if you see another Orthodox Jew, if you see a Jew wearing a shetel on your hand, if I see someone wearing a yarmulke, you're walking through the airport, I'm walking out, I've got my carry-on behind me, Baruch Hashem, not flying Delta, that's why we landed safely, not upside down. And you see another Orthodox Jew, as you're getting out, they're waiting for the incoming flight, and you just do this. That's all it is. I keep score. How many Jew nods did I have as I walked from my flight all the way to Hertz Rent-A-Car? I just want to know, how many Jews did I see? Why do we do that? Especially now, there's like a little bit of like a safety of like, I have my chevra around. I'm not by myself. Doesn't count, by the way, if you're flying El Al. There's no Jew nods. That's already together. Community, we walk by each other. We don't say good Shabbos. I'm talking about like, unless you're from out of town, then the whole time you're busy by El Al. But if you're from the New York, New Jersey area, it doesn't count if you're by El Al. Why is it that if I'm walking through the airport in Dallas, I'm going like, oh, there's another one. There's a sense of security that it brings when we're with each other because it just doesn't feel very safe in the world right now. It's a crazy thing to say. It's not just anti-Semitism. There's a darkness that's descended upon the world. The values of the world have become completely corrupt. Things that were completely abnormal 40 years ago, that everybody in the world would have said, no, we'll never reach that level. The world won't allow us to reach that level. Now it's like de rigueur to say that it's normal, and that if you say that it's not normal, then you're canceled. It's a crazy time to live in. I have to be careful what I say publicly because I don't want to be canceled. I mean, it doesn't really matter to me if that side cancels me, but like, it's just, you know, I want to reach as many people as I can. But you have to be careful what you say about things that are, I imagine you have the same thing. Do you ever wonder what it's going to be like in 20 years from now? You ever think to yourself, like, what's next? It's a real thing to think about. Like, because, yeah, it has to be Mashiach, right? Because 40 years ago, if you would have told us this is where we were going to be holding, we would have said, like, okay, it's cute, but like everybody has some level of boundaries. Now there's no boundaries. Good is evil is good. That which is morally virtuous is despicable. That which is despicable is not morally virtuous. There's a tremendous darkness. What are we doing here? I want to share with you a Torah from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. This is a mind-blowing Torah. You have to get this Torah very deeply. The Gemara in Shabbos tells us what's the cause of anti-Semitism. It began by Har Sinai. Har Sinai is named Miloshon Sinah. Once we got the Torah at Har Sinai, that began the Sinah of anti-Semitism. Without Torah, there was no anti-Semitism. In other words, Klal Yisrael Mitzrayim was not oppressed by the Egyptians because of anti-Semitism. That began by Har Sinai. So it's a fascinating thing. Suffering we had before Har Sinai. Hatred began after Har Sinai. What's the difference between the persecution of pre-Har Sinai and post-Har Sinai? So the Rebbe says as follows. We know that the Gemara in Megillah tells us that Haman tried to buy off Achashverosh. You know this? Haman tried to make a deal with Achashverosh. He came to Achashverosh and he said, I'm going to give you 10,000 talents of silver if you'll allow me to destroy Klal Yisrael. Achashverosh said, keep your money. You could do it anyway. You could do it for free. Yeah, that's a good anti-Semite. I don't even want your money. You could do it for free. The Gemara compares this to someone who has a mound and a ditch. The person has a mound, another person has a ditch. The guy with the ditch comes to the mound, and the guy with the mound, and he says, sell me your mound. The guy with the mound says, just take it. I don't want the mound. You have a ditch. Just do it. That's what the Gemara compares it to. So the Rebbe explains as follows. Achashverosh has the mound, Haman has the ditch. These are two types of anti-Semites. Achashverosh is what we'll call mild anti-Semitism. It's light anti-Semitism. He doesn't like us because we're different. You know, like sociologists call it, they call it dislike for the unlike. You know that phrase, dislike for the unlike? We don't like people that aren't like us. We're different. We're different. So some Jews throughout history said, I'm going to get a nose job. Then I won't look so different, right? I'm going to get a job in the secular world. I won't look so different. I'll take off my yarmulke. I'll take off my tzitzis. I'll shave my payas. I'll do whatever I need to do in order to assimilate because I don't want to be unlike you. That's mild anti-Semitism. That's not what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about extreme anti-Semitism. That's the anti-Semitism that we've been experiencing in our dar. This is the anti-Semitism of Haman. Haman is the ditch. And the ditch is as follows. But this is where you got to lock in because this is the work right now. Every one of us in this room is carrying with us a hole inside of ourselves. The only question is what you fill the hole with. I'm going to say it again. Every one of us is living with a hole. You have two options. What do you want to fill the hole with? You can fill the hole with power, or you can fill the hole with submission. Everybody in this room, including myself, at various times in our lives, attempts to fill the hole in our lives with power. I'll give you just one of a million examples. Here's my first one. When somebody dies, what's the first question we ask? How old were they? Or how did it happen? Why do we need to know? Because it's very... By the way, we can't avoid it. Right? We can't avoid it. But if I know how somebody died, tell me how it happened so that I could have the power to make sure that it doesn't happen again. Right, so if somebody died of a heart attack, so it's like, okay, I got to take care of myself. If somebody got hit by a car, I have to teach my children to cross the street safely. Right? Really, that's not the way life works. But in that vacuum that we carry within us, there's a fear. That hole is very scary. And we try our best to fill it with power. Can I give you another example? Why do we need to build wealth? Why do we need to build wealth? If you think about it, building wealth is completely irrational. Rabbi Dr. Abraham Chaytorsky, you're familiar with Zecher Tzadik Livracha, he was a very, very special person. Rabbi Twersky gives a great mashal for this. He said, imagine a client comes into a therapist's office and he says to the therapist, he's like, yeah, I guess I need some help. Can you help me? The therapist says, sure. What's the problem? He goes, I don't really think I have a problem. So the therapist smiles. He knows this story, right? It's like, okay, you don't have a problem. So why are you here? He goes, I don't know. My parents told me I have a problem. My friends told me I have a problem. My sister and my brother told me I have a problem. So the therapist is going, okay, clearly this guy's got a problem. This is okay. So what do they think the problem is? They think the problem is that I like pancakes. I don't think it's a problem that I like pancakes, but they think it's a problem that I like pancakes. So the therapist says to the client, he goes, I don't think that's a problem either. I mean, I like pancakes too. The client's eyes go wide and he goes, you like pancakes? You should come to my house. I have suitcases and suitcases and suitcases full of pancakes. How much, was that Mashiach? Yeah. Just practicing for Elul already? How much money do we need? How much money do we need? You know what the answer is? From a psychological perspective, we need enough money for now and the foreseeable future. And yet, people spend their lives making obscene amounts of money. For what? For what? At what point? You have enough for now, you have enough for the foreseeable future. Why are you still working? So people come up with different answers, but sometimes the real answer is, I love money. Why do you love money so much? You know, sometimes you look at these people that are, so, you know, when we were growing up, it was like a millionaire was the thing, right? Like they're a millionaire. Today, if you're not a millionaire, you're a lo yutzlach, right? It's like, come talk to me. The guy has $500 million, $1 billion. These are real numbers in the Jewish community. I have met people who have hundreds of millions of dollars in the Jewish community. That's an unbelievable thing. You got to ask them. I don't ask them because it's not, you know, like, polite. I want to, like, what are you still working for? If you spent every day of your life trying to spend this money, you couldn't. You could not run through it. Why are you still working? You know what the answer is? On some level, it feels awesome to have the power of money. My father once told me, anything that money can solve is not a problem. I said, Dad, it's easy for you to say, you have money. He said, no, you don't understand. If let's say, chas v'shalom, in our community, let's say somebody was in a car accident and it was going to cost $1 million to hire the best surgeon to save this kid's life, how fast do you think we'd have $1 million in our community? I think we'd have $1 million within an hour. If they put out a GoFundMe, none of us would know this kid. If they put out a GoFundMe, we heard that Chas v'Shalom, a kid in a certain neighborhood was in a terrible car accident. We need $1 million in 1 hour from now to save this kid's life. We'd have $1 million overnight. Today, there's a beautiful thing that Klal Yisrael does, that if Chas v'Shalom, somebody loses a husband, so the community gets together and we put together, in like 48 hours, we put together $1 million, this family now is taken care of. I said to my father, it's easy to say that money can solve a problem if you have money. My father said, no, you don't understand. Money we have. It's when money can't solve a problem that it's a real problem. Money is power. It really is. It gives us a level of control over the world. There is a methodology that people live with. I live with this too. I'm not saying I'm better than anybody. We all live with this. On some level, we all crave power. Kochi va'otzem yadi. Look at us. I've got this figured out. I'm okay. That's why children are so terrifying, no? No. By the way, there were two types of faces just now in the room. Those that laughed out loud and those that went like this. I'm with both of you, yeah? If you've had children, and you know when they hit that stage when they realize they're more powerful than you? So it was eight? Okay, I heard eight over here. In my experience, it's somewhere around the ages, depending boy or girl, somewhere between 12 and 15 years old. It's like, what are you going to do to me? You're going to ground me? What are you going to do if I walk out? You're going to take away my phone? What if I buy my own? Like, at some point, these kids realize I'm much more powerful than you. That's why, by the way, if you ever see parents do that, you ever see parents exert control over their children? It's terrifying to watch. When parents literally, like, lift their child, I mean, like, I am now moving you to a new place. Or that kid who has that temper tantrum in the middle of Gourmet Glot, you know what I'm saying? And you're like, shoot, I'm being... Okay, that was heavy. I wasn't choosing Gourmet Glot for any specific reason. It's just where I once saw it happen, yeah? And I saw this kid was having a temper tantrum, and I saw the mother could not handle it, right? And she just lifted the child up and moved the child, right? Like, because she didn't want to be judged by everybody else in the neighborhood as her kid is having a temper tantrum in the middle of Gourmet Glot because that kid wanted the cookie. We can exert control over the child until we can't. It's terrifying to do things that you don't have power over. So one movement in this world is I have power. The other movement in this world is I have no power and I'm completely submitted to the fact that I have no power. Those are the only two movements that I know about in this world. People who are attempting to have irrational power over their lives that they don't really have, and people are submitted to the fact that there's no way I'm going to have any power. There is a God, and I submit myself to God. Can I tell you a story? This is a true story. It's happening right now. A dear friend of mine is the craziest story in the world. Shabbos morning, I'm guessing now it's like 2.5 months ago, Shabbos morning, he turns to his wife, and he says to his wife, I have a terrible headache. I think I need to go to the hospital. She says, you don't need to go to the hospital. You just have a bad headache. Go lie down. He said, no, I think my brain is bleeding. She's like, your brain is not bleeding. And then he collapsed. They rushed him to the hospital. He has cancer all over his body. They had to do emergency surgery, taking out tumors from his brain. He's fighting it now. Be'ez Hashem, he'll have a refuah shleima. Everyone in the world is going to visit him. He's an amazing person. His name is Rabbi Jonathan Cohen. He's an amazing, amazing guy. It's the craziest thing. I'm watching my friend confront his own mortality and basically come to the recognition, I mean, I could take the pill, I could go to get the scans, they could see if it's going better or worse, but at the end of the day, do you make it, do you not make it? You know what the doctors do, it's just numbers, it's just percentages. 90%, 70%, 40%, 30%, those who live, those who die, it's not in any of our hands, it's all in the hands of Hashem. This attitude of, and this is what Klal Yisrael did by our Sinai, we are not in charge in this world. There is a God. We live by his laws. That's what happened by our Sinai. A group of people came together in front of God and said, you tell us how to live. We live that way because we live harmoniously with God. You want to make it less frum just to make it like easy for yourself? I live harmoniously with my soul. I live deeply connected to the part of me that's larger than myself. That's a way of living. My children are having a temper tantrum. I'm not in control over this moment. It's not my job to fix this moment. This moment isn't broken. How many of us are living this way? It's so hard to live this way. I'm having shalom bias issues with my husband. I'm having shalom bias issues with my children. I'm having shalom bias issues with my neighbors. How many of us are willing to say, it's okay. I don't need to fix this. I'm going to show up. I'm going to make the next right step. And I'm going to show up with integrity. But I am not in control of this situation. I'm not in control of my children. I'm not in control over my husband. I'm not in control over my boss. I'm not in control over my child's Rebbe, who I don't like the way that he's treating my child. I'm not in control over these things. I'm just going to make the next right choice as I submit to Hashem and His will. That is a very profound way of living. That's the goal of a Jew. If you really, again, a lot of times we speak about like what it means to be a Yid, and we speak about it in like a very esoteric way. We can boil this down and make it very simple. Do we live with humility submitted to Hashem? I'm going to say a nice word about Barry. I know I do this a lot. I know I do it too much, but I'm going to say a nice word about Barry. You know this thing she's trying to do is irrational, right? You know this thing right here that we're doing doesn't make any sense? Like if somebody came to you and said, I'm going to start an organization to take frum women and do kiruv. Right, this, because that you want to call it inspiration, you want to call it kiruv, whatever you chizik, whatever words you want to do, right? It's kiruv, not kiruv rechokim, it's not kiruv krovim. I don't know what it is, but we're trying to bring people closer to Hashem. How many of us would have said to Barry, I think you're a little bit crazy. I don't think women in the middle of February are going to get up and come to Eretz Yisrael for a week to be mechazik themselves. I think I would have said that, yeah? And I'm guessing that probably even though you're the ones that came, I'm guessing you would have said it. You would say it too. You would have said, I would do it, but I don't know if there's a critical mass of people that would do it, right? And the attempt, how many shiurim do we have now weekly?
Nine.
Mrs. Smiles. I'm saying it's a lot, right? It's a lot.
And every night, daily dose of bitachon.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
And
yeah, so you know this is a pretty silly thing to do, right? You know this like, al pi derech hateva shouldn't work. Right? I'll give you another example. You know this building that we're sitting in right now? You know it's like not really a normal thing. There was a man whose name was Avnayach Weinberg, and he decided, and he said, I'm gonna return Jews to Judaism. I'm gonna tell them that this is their Yerusha. So he came to Yerushalayim and he built this, and then, by the way, this new building that we're in right now, I once spoke to Rabbi Steven Berg, who's the CEO of H Global, and he told me even this that we're sitting with in like right now, it's absolute nisim. The ability to build on the most coveted like spot of real estate in the world. I mean, it's like this is pretty serious business. We're not living miraculously. The irony is that people who are seeking power, they'll only ever be so successful. They'll only ever be as successful as the power that they have can bring them. So if you're like, let's say there's 10 levels of power, maybe you reach 10 levels of power. Maybe you're the president of the United States and you have awesome power. But that's all you really have. A Jew who submitted to Hashem is infinitely powerful because God is infinite. So I'm telling you very straight, 10 levels of power could not build this building. Belief in Hashem could build this building. Barry, I'm giving you a musr. It's the sweetest sledgehammer musr. I'm giving you a musr. If you try to make the chizik mission happen, it won't happen. Because you'll only have X level of power to make this happen. But I know what you're doing, and you're going, I don't know how to do this, but Hashem's going to have to make this happen. I'm just going to be the vessel for him. And we already see the peros that are abnormal, that it's more than it should be. And it's working. Why? Because it's not kochi v'otzim yadi. Because I'm submitted to Hashem. There's an irony. People who try to control their children can't. People who stop trying to control their children and give it over to God, something changes in the children. It's an amazing thing. People who are trying to control their husbands, this is a gift I can give you. I promise you, it's not going to work. You know what men hate? Women that try to control them. A man is a horse. Yeah? And it's a wild stallion. This thing that you're going to do, like, I'm going to fix him. No, you're not. It's going to take an act of God to fix that man. Yeah? So you could try. I see we have one single girl in the audience here. How old are you?
21.
You're making Aliyah? Where are you going to be living? Baca. I've heard of Baca. Very nice. There's a school there, MMY.
Yes.
That's our sister school. So when you're dating, what was that? I've heard of Midmo. Rav Rafi is one of my closest friends. Usually when you say Rav Rafi's name to the seminary girls, they bow down. You know, he's like
Arova.
Oh, you went to Arova, okay. The idea that you're going to try to... we all feel a little bad for her. No, she's going to go on this, you're going to go on this journey. Are you dating already? It's okay, it's the chizik mission, you can be real. Now that I'm here, so now I could start. You're going to meet a guy and you're going to go like... I remember my wife told me that she, when we were dating, she asked one of her abayim about me, and she said, he's very immature. And the Rebbe said, don't worry, it passes. And my wife's like, when? You know, like, I'm 45 years old. When is this thing going to pass? It's not going to work. You're not going to fix us. You can stop trying. But an amazing thing happens. A woman who doesn't try to fix her husband and just respects who he is and accepts him for who he is, an amazing thing happens. An act of God. All of a sudden, he's the guy that you wanted him to be. This is Haman. This is Amalek. I will not let go of the reins. There is no God. There is no morality. All there is power. And in a world of fear, I will dominate somebody else. A Jew builds a nest on the shore of this world. And we say, I'm sorry, a Jew is the sea of this world, trying to lap ourselves up on the shore, saying, there is a God. There are rules to this game. Listen to the rules of the game. Stop trying to amass power. Let go. By the way, isn't that the rule of the sea? You're not going to control the sea. Haman says, I'm going to build a nest. What's the nest? The nest is, there is no God. All there is power. What does the sea do? Naturally, not because we're trying to start a fight. What does the sea do? The sea says, sorry, brother. Power doesn't exist. Power is an illusion. This thing you're trying to do with your life, it doesn't exist. By the way, that's why COVID freaked us all out. Because what happened when COVID hit? We lost the illusion of control. That's why people went crazy. In my neighborhood, and by the way, we crushed children. For those of you that were paying attention that had children going through COVID, that's a bad experiment. Like, let's lock children in the room for a year and a half and see what happens. If a kid has COVID, I did this to my own child. Looking back on it, I'm like, what did I do? My daughter got COVID. I put her in a room for 2 weeks by herself. We came to visit. That's a crazy thing. A child should not spend 2 weeks in a room. She had, like, outdoor time, you know what I'm saying? She was like in jail. Like, it was, you know, she should have worn an orange jumpsuit. It was a miserable thing to do. Why were we so absolutely intense about it? We didn't know. And in the absence of not knowing, we exerted power to try to control something that we couldn't. Now we know we can't control these things. We'll do our best, but we're not willing to sacrifice our children when things go badly in the world. We miss the illusion of control. We never had control, but we felt like we did. That's power. We're in a fight against power. That's what it means to be a Jew. What's Haman's strategy? Now I'm going to kill the Jews because I have to. Like Hitler said, you know the famous line from Hitler? Hitler said, the struggle for world domination is between me and the Jews. All else is meaningless. The Jews have inflicted two wounds upon the world, circumcision for the body and conscience for the soul. I come to free mankind from their shackles. That's what Hitler said. Hillary Machimo said this. He said, I'm going to destroy this notion of morality. Power is the only thing that exists. I have to kill the Jews. That's what happened by our Sinai. How do we do that? It's very simple. You got to take dry land and bring it into the sea. You got to take the sea and bring it into dry land. We're running out of time, so I'm going to say this a little bit quickly, but I don't want you to lose the message. A Jew is a fish in the sea. That's what we are. The famous mashal with Rav Akiva, you all know the famous mashal. That Rav Akiva said, I have to continue teaching Torah because if you take me away from Torah, you're taking a fish onto dry land, and that is unsafe. Haman said, I know how to take a fish out of the sea. I know how to disconnect a Jew from Torah. I know how to disconnect a Jew from Hashem. It's very simple. Let's give them the feeling of power. What I'm about to say is not a nice thing. I feel badly to say a not nice thing, but I'm saying not a nice thing. We, a little bit in our world, we're making the same mistake they made on Purim. Why was there a gzar din that we were going to die? Because we were nene from the Suda of Achashverosh. Because we went to the Suda of Achashverosh and we enjoyed it. Was the food kosher? The Gemara says the food was glatt kosher. Badatz, Eid, Charedis, Reuben, Landau, whatever the best Hechsherim are, all the ions. You know how like you can tell if like a Hechsher is good because it has a million ions in it? I want to tell the OU, if you just add ions, you'll be more Shavu L'chol Nefesh. You have no ions. Chaval, it's in English. You should change it to Weissmandel OU. Then people will eat it. It's a Hamisha crowd. You have to make Hamisha jokes. Haimisha jokes, depending where you're from. Yeah. We're walking around going, I was invited to the White House. That's what we do. I was invited to give the invocation at the Republican National Convention or at the Democratic National Convention. Or we were invited to be there when the president gets elected. What are we so proud of? Why are we so proud to be walking around the White House? A little bit, a little bit. Again, there's an opportunity for Kiddush Hashem, and we have to take that opportunity. I'm not saying we shouldn't. There's an opportunity for Kiddush Hashem, we have to take it. But how many of us are walking around feeling like, we made it. We could walk the halls of the White House. We made it. We could get an audience with the president if we want. There's a disconnect from our identity as Yidden. We are the children of the Rabbanu Shel Olam. Why are you so excited to meet Trump? You're much, much bigger than Trump. Your identity as a Jew is much more precious than your ability to get an audience with Basar Vedam. Klal Yisrael was walking around by the Suda of Achashverosh going, we made it. We made it. We're here. We're in the palace of Achashverosh. It probably felt awesome for them. Eating the best food, hearing the best music, walking in the gardens. They said, look at us. But you're house Jews. That's not your majesty. That's not your godliness. You're much bigger than that. And you're running around being proud of the crumbs that you ate. That's the insanity of being a Jew today. We do not have, and I'm including the Orthodox community in this, I'm including the Hamish community in this, I'm talking everywhere, in the world, in Eretz Yisrael. We have lost Jewish identity. I know it sounds like a funny thing. I keep Shabbos, I keep kosher, my kids wear tefillin, my sons are in Kailo, my son-in-laws are in Kailo, we're running chesed organizations, you're telling me I lost Jewish identity? Yes. We forgot about the majesty of being a Yid. You want to know why we're having trouble raising our children? Because we're raising our children in a way, I don't think this is the be-all and end-all answer, but it's worth saying, we're not raising our children to know that they're awesome. We're not raising our children. You know, if you were, let's say, the son of a player on the Knicks, how awesome does that kid feel? He walks into Madison Square Garden. I assume everybody's from New York. That's because I'm from New York, so I just assume everybody's from New York. You walk into Madison Square Garden. You're walking around. All the most famous people in the world are dapping you up, right? And you're in the world's most famous arena, and you get to see every game. You come back to school, and the kids say, oh, that's so cool. Your dad is this, Nick. You're unbelievable. You're awesome. That kid, he walks around saying, I'm awesome. He introduces himself. Hi, I'm Plony. I'm the son of a famous Nick. Our children should be walking around saying, hi, my name is Avram, and I am the child of Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. I am the descendants of royalty that changed the world. It's so not like that. We're so distant. I know it sounds like a funny thing. We're distant from Jewish identity. We keep all of the halachos. Somehow the soul of Yiddishkeit got lost. Why? Because Haman said, I know how to destroy this nest. I know how to destroy this sea. I just have to start taking him one at a time. I'm just going to take him over to the Suda of Achashverosh. And when they're there, they're going to fall into the world of power. That's what it is. Look at me. I can get an audience with Achashverosh. I have power. Once you're in the world of power, you're out of the world of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Comes along HaKadosh Baruch Hu and answers the most unbelievable question in the world. He says, Haman, I tried this already. When Klal Yisrael sinned by the Chet HaEgel, I said, I'm going to destroy them. They were worthy of being destroyed. How come you can't destroy a Yid? HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you know why? Because they're me. A Jew is a godly soul. Our soul is like a ray of the sun. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the sun, we're the ray. I can't destroy a Jew any more than I can destroy myself. You think you're going to destroy a Jew because you took him away from his Jewish identity? Good luck. Try it. It doesn't work. It's an amazing thing. We saw it since October 7th, but the truth is we saw it throughout history. How many Jews right now are standing up? Jews that are completely not Orthodox. Now I'm putting on tefillin. Even small things. I don't want to say silly things, but even small things. I wear the dog tags. I wear the yellow ribbon. I'm an advocate. Why? People who were totally disconnected from Judaism, they're so connected right now. Why? What changed? You know, the answer is you cannot destroy a Jew. We are living in a period of anti-Semitism because, and this has been throughout history, at the end of the Purim story, we are still Avadim Ta'achashverosh. We still live in a world of power. We still live in a world of darkness, and we have a need out of fear for control. It's a very simple answer. The darkness is what proves the light. I'm going to show you who you really are. A mother can't stop being a mother. A child who is super disconnected from the mother can't stop davening for that child. Why? It's my kid. I can't stop being a mother any more than a Jew can stop being a Jew. It's your identity. but you're disconnected from identity? Yeah, you're disconnected on an external layer. But internally, it's hard to do. A chaver of mine, one of my closest friends in the world, is not an observant Jew. He would literally eat pork on Yom Kippur. He does. He lives in the Czech Republic because it's the most atheistic country in the world. He's completely disconnected on an observance level. Calls me up a couple of years ago. He goes, "I'm so frustrated." I said, "What?" It was like a couple weeks from now. It was before Pesach. He saw the Chabad Shliach of Brno in the Czech Republic walking by him. And he says, "Good Yontif." This guy goes without a yarmulke. You would in a million years not be able to tell he's Jewish. Even the Lubavitchers, who are trained to be able to find Jewish people that don't look Jewish, even they couldn't tell that he was Jewish. Now the Chabad Shliach goes, "Oh, we have a Jew here. He won't leave my friend alone." So my friend called me up to complain. He's like, "I can't get this guy off of me." So I said, "Why did you wish him a good Yom Tov?" He goes, "Don't start with me. I know what you're going to say. Pintaliyad. You can't destroy the Pintaliyad. I know this move. It's not true. I was just messing with the guy." I said, "Yeah, were you really? Are you sure?" "It's not true. He's lying to himself. He said good Yom Tov because on some subconscious level, he wanted that guy to know that he was a Jew. This guy has run so far away from Judaism, and yet he still says good Yom Tov. He came to Eretz Yisrael after October 7th. I went out to eat with him. It was the first time in years. Again, this guy was a stark yeshiva guy. He was my chavrusa. We would wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning to learn together. He was an unbelievable guy. We were out. We went to Katzefet, like a good seminary girl. We went to Katzefet, and he was saying, he's like, "You know I don't believe in the miraculous." Is but the way that Joe Biden has handled post October 7th, it's miraculous. Without Biden, what would we have done? I heard him say the word "we." And I didn't want to like call him out. I didn't want to be like, "Ah, you said we." You know, it's not exactly like a good Kirov tactic, you know. But I saw, as far as this guy ran away, can't run away. The darkness is the gift, the most painful gift in the world, but it's the gift that tells us who we are. We're here on this mission because everyone in this room on some level is unsatisfied in their Judaism. That's why we're here. We're here. I'm a part of this. I really am. I'm a part of this. We're here because we're unsatisfied with our Judaism. We're tired of showing up, performing, keeping Shabbos, davening, keeping kosher, glatt kosher, covering our hair, doing all the right things, totally tznius. We're here because something is missing. But do you realize the gift of the fact that something is missing? Because if nothing was missing, how would you ever discover who you are? If you never had death, how would you appreciate life? If you never had darkness, how would you appreciate life? If you never lose your identity, how will you ever find it? Anti-Semitism is a gift. And you have to know how to mine the nugget. The gift of anti-Semitism is, it's the most painful thing in the world, destruction of millions of Jews historically, millions, tens of millions. But the greatest gift in the world is that it keeps proving to us time and time again, this is who we are. How do we bring Mashiach? Is a very simple equation. I'm letting go of power. I'm connecting deeply to my identity. I am a shtick of Hashem. That's what I am. There's a little piece of the Abishter inside of me. I am totally powerless, and therefore I am infinitely powerful. I have majesty. I have unbelievable royalty coursing through my veins. I walk through the streets proud. I share it with my children. I share it with my husband. I'm not, Barry says this all the time, this is not just about you. The impact that we're having on your family, because you take this back with you, it changes the way you are as a mother. It changes the way you are as a wife. It changes the way you are as a member of your community. You'll have Jewish chutzpah. At the end of this trip, I hope you have Jewish chutzpah. You know what Jewish chutzpah means? Jewish chutzpah means you show up to the world and you go, "I can change this." Only a Yid could think that way. Only a Yid could think, "I'm going to change the entire world." And historically speaking, we have. So as I'm already out of time because we got to go down to the Kotel because you're going up north now. What's the bottom line takeaway message? We're about to embark on this thing called the Chizuk Mission. If you show up over the next couple of days and you came for a tourist visit, I'm going to see the sites. What are we doing? We're visiting things. We're going around. We'll see bases and different. No.
Lots of learning.
Okay. You're going up north. Where are you going?
We're going to Tzfat.
Okay. You go. You could see the artist colony. Right. You'll go to the Kivrei Tzaddikim. You'll do the whole thing. If you show up to a shir and you're there in body, you're listening, but you're not open. If you show up that way, you missed the most incredible opportunity. But if you say, I am here to connect to my truest identity, I'm here to connect to my soul, I'm willing to confront all the darkness in my life because all the darkness in my life tells me who I really am, this will be another notch. It won't be the transformative experience of your life, but it'll be another notch in a series of transformative experiences that Be'ezus Hashem will make you the person that you hope to become in your life. Deeply connected to yourself, deeply connected to Hashem.